and welcome to Canary Pod, the podcast from the team behind the Canary. I'm Nancy Mendoza, Director of Communications and Membership at the Canary, and I've got with me editors John Ranson and Emily Apple, and Canary writer Tamara Mickner. Welcome, team.
Hello.
Hello.
So this week it is bombs, badgers, and bigotry. We've got three stories to bring to you this week, and I'm going to start with Emily Apple. Emily, this week, London has been host to one of the world's biggest and most significant arms fairs. Traditionally, these arms fairs are protested against, and you know, there's usually some drama around it, and hopefully, eventually, some progress to kind of uncover some of what is going on in these fairs. Tell us a bit about what's been happening this time.
The arms fair is called Defence and Security Equipment International, and it's known as DICEY. And they had, in 2015, 1,500 exhibitors, including the top 10 arms manufacturers. Now, where it becomes controversial is over some of the countries that are invited. So, for example, 14 of them, including Algeria and Bahrain, have authoritarian regimes. Four, including Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, have human rights issues. Mm. And then others are currently at war, such as Ukraine and Iraq.
Right.
Stop the Arms Fair have been holding a week of action last week to stop the Arms Fair before it even starts. And so for about 7 days, there's been blockades, there's been incredibly complex lock-ons, which have involved kind of big rucksacks filled with tar and wire and all sorts of things that have taken the police hours to get through to move protesters from the road.
Can you just explain what a lock-on is? That's not a term I'm familiar with.
A lock-on is when people attach themselves to each other, generally to blockade somewhere.
Right.
And you can do it using sort of tubes, which you put your arms through. Mm. And in this case, they'd use luggage,
yeah,
and which had armholes sort of cut through it. And generally, people connect to each other through the armholes with carabiners.
Right.
And it therefore makes it very hard for the police to move protesters out of the way, and they get to hold the road for a lot longer if
Amazing.
They're locked onto each other.
And have they been successful?
They've been very successful. There's been over 100 arrested throughout the week. And according to contractors around the place, because they were drinking in all the local pubs, so lots of people ended up talking to them, they were over 4 days delayed setting up the arms fair.
Wow.
So it's caused a lot of problems for them. But unfortunately, it is still continuing this week.
You know, clearly, nobody really likes war. Well, very few people. but
arms dealers do.
Right, arms dealers do. But this is about more than just, you know, the sale of arms and the movement of, you know, UK made arms elsewhere in the world. There's quite a lot of quite scary politics going on behind this. I wonder if you could outline that.
People have been protesting, for example, at the UK arms sales to Saudi Arabia, which has totaled 3.8 billion since 2015.
Goodness me.
And these arms are being used in Yemen in what the UN has described as the largest humanitarian crisis in the world. There's been 5,144 civilians killed. Now, this includes 1,184 children. And according to the UN, the leading cause of these child casualties is through the Saudi-led coalition, which is doing the bombing. And it's these billions of pounds worth of arms that are being sold at places like DICEY that are contributing to these deaths.
Mm.
So it's very much, with DICEY, it's a big networking event where all these arms dealers, government officials, military officials come together, they meet each other, they get to try out the equipment, they get to have a laugh with each other. And this is where these deals are made and these connections are made that lead to people dying around the world.
That's just, I'm just kind of visualising in my mind, you know, I think about my own experiences of, you know, attending scientific conferences and NUS conferences when I was a student and stuff like that. And I, you know, I get what you mean about, you know, you get together with people who've got a similar kind of interest and you have a really nice time. But the idea of kind of going and, you know, networking and drinking and having a laugh when, you know, the subject matter is so serious. We're talking about, you know, arming Saudi Arabia. We're talking about one of the most horrific regimes in the world, which is perpetrating some absolutely heinous acts. And yet in the UK, we're saying, oh, no, that's fine. You come, you have a look at, you know, what weapons and craft and whatever you want to buy. And, you know, we just won't talk about the human rights abuses because it's, you know, this is just business and that's not really cricket, is it? I always find it quite surreal. Have you actually been down to the protest?
Yes, I've been at the protests all last week.
What was that like?
Oh, there was a very good atmosphere there. There were different themes for different days. So, for example, the first day was about stop arming Israel and about arms sales to Israel. And there's, for example, one of the women talking at that protest was talking about EBIT and the weapons that they sell, and they advertise them as being battle tested. Mm. And as she was saying, being battle tested means that they've been used on people in Gaza.
Yeah.
But this is what they're using to promote their sales.
Absolutely.
There was a No Borders Day. There was a No Faith in the Arms Trade Day, which saw Quakers abseiling off a bridge and blocking the road.
Amazing.
Yeah. Oh, and it sort of culminated in a big day of action on the Saturday, which saw sort of hundreds of people blockading both entrances. There's two entrances to where the arms fair is held for sort of 5 or 6 hours, and really no traffic could get in to sort of set up the arms fair. So it was a really, really good day of action.
That's amazing. It's just a really clear message to the organisers and then attendees that, you know, we as a community of people in the UK are just not okay with this. You know,
no,
we're really
absolutely
not okay with it.
No, and the more people coming out and saying that and saying this is not happening in my name is what will stop these events from happening.
So what can people do?
Well, people can do all sorts of things. Probably by the time this podcast comes out, the actual arms fair will be over. But these companies have offices and factories all around the country. Mm. And Campaign Against the Arms Trade have a very nice map that you can visit on their website that will tell you where your nearest arms dealer is if you want to protest there. And there'll also be plans for protests in 2019 against the arms fair, which people can start getting involved with probably quite soon.
And what's the aim for 2019?
It will be to shut it down again and to try and build on what we need to do in 2019 is build on success of this year. This year has shown that we really can make a difference in delaying the setup and stopping it from happening. If we can mobilise even further and get even more people out in 2019, I think we actually do stand a really good chance of shutting this thing down. And the bottom line is that if these people can't get there, if they can't network, if they can't make those connections, it really does stand the chance of saving lives somewhere else in the world.
That's a really powerful call to action. We'll include some links in the show notes for the Campaign Against the Arms Trade website and any other resources that we can find.
One of the things that I came across when I was writing a bit about DICE this week as well is that 4 of the 5 countries that are members of the UN, permanent members of the UN Security Council, are also in the top, are also among the top arms exporters in the world.
Right.
And so those countries are the UK, France, Russia, and the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when we think about why is the UN so slow to condemn, you know, some kind of conflict or some type of human rights abuse or some type of war, I think that helps contextualize one of the things that might be behind it. You know, if countries like these and also Germany, and, you know, are profiting really from selling arms to enable some of the worst conflicts that are happening, then we're not necessarily going to expect them to be condemning the very same kind of events that is earning them money and that is supporting an entire industry in their country.
Yeah.
And I think also one of the points that Campaign Against the Arms Trade has made, which I think is valuable, is that, you know, ending the arms industry doesn't mean that we want people to lose their jobs, and it doesn't mean that people need to lose their jobs either. Mm. And, you know, some of the same companies that make military weapons also make civilian, you know, kind of Absolutely. Civil society products, right? So it's just a matter of shifting what these companies are making and shifting what kind of products trained people who are engineers and so on are producing.
Yeah, I mean, military-funded research has produced all sorts of things that are useful for civilians. I've worked with a lot of scientific organisations through my career, and as a great example, I worked with a group that had made a new device to treat motion sickness. It's a bit like a TENS machine that you use for back pain, but you put it on your scalp and it quietens down a part of your brain that is contributing to travel sickness. And it's really, really effective. But the only way that they're going to be able to kind of develop that and get it to a kind of commercial state where it would be available for anybody who was, you know, about to go on a ship or likely to get car sick, is through the military, because there's a massive interest from the military, because the pilots of drones suffer really, really badly from motion sickness because they're in effectively a virtual reality environment and they don't know which way is up. So you know, the chances are is this extraordinary bit of kit will make it to, you know, the shelves of Boots or, you know, whichever your local pharmacy is that you prefer. But, you know, the route there will be a military application, and that's partly because, you know, there's an awful lot of money behind all of this. So it's going to be very interesting to see if it is possible to kind of, you know, focus those talents more on civilian applications. But, you know, I have my doubts, to be honest.
So yeah, one of the problems is that government is so embedded with Dicey and the arms trade. Dicey itself is sponsored by the Ministry of Defence and the Department for International Trade, and Liam Fox, the International Trade Secretary, was one of the keynote speakers, and he's talking about the fact that this is an ethical arms fair and that our arms exports are ethical. You sort of think, well,
really?
Yes, to all the children who are dying from them. So it's so embedded in UK politics, and I think it's been really interesting that the main politician who's spoken out about it is Caroline Lucas of the Green Party. Labour have been quite quiet. The Tories have obviously been incredibly quiet because they support it all. And the other problem is post-Brexit, with all this focus on trade talks, a lot of that focus on trade talks is on arms sales because that's one of our biggest exports. So, you know, it's looking like Brexit will be paid for in blood if the government get their way and these trade deals go ahead in selling weapons.
Oh, gosh, that's pretty scary. Thank you, Emily. That's really exciting, and I'm looking forward very much to seeing what CAT achieve in 2019. Let's hope that they manage to shut the thing down. Okay, and now on to badgers. John Manson is joining us to talk badgers. So when we're talking about badgers, you know, surprisingly enough, you know, this is also really a case of vested interests and powerful lobbies to Parliament, you know, far more than it's to do with any kind of science around the transmission of bovine TB. John, do you want to just talk us through kind of the latest news, and then maybe we can look a little bit at the long history of this badger culling policy in its various forms?
Yeah, the latest is that we know that in the second week of September, the badger cull has begun. There have been reports of cage traps and dead badgers in various parts of the west of England. The badger cull this year is vastly expanded on previous years. The government has set a target this year of a minimum of nearly 22,000 badgers to be killed, up to a maximum of nearly 34,000.
Gosh, and that is in what area? What sort of land area and where?
Well, this year it's taking place in 21 areas, which are mostly across the west and the southwest of England,
right?
From Devon up to Worcestershire. And this is a big increase on last year, where there were 10 areas, and the total number of badgers killed last year was just under 11,000, which in itself was a huge increase from previous years. So this is something which is, in many ways, you know, a very stark result of the general election.
Right.
Labour promised in its manifesto that it would cease the badger cull. It said we will stop the badger cull, which makes the situation worse rather than better. And but the Tories managed to cling on to power, and as a result, 30,000 badgers are going to be killed in the next few weeks. This is a pretty big tragedy for the badgers, and it's not great, to be honest, for the farming industry.
Well,
because
so this is the thing. I mean, I don't think, I mean, nobody really is going to go, you know, let's go around killing our beloved wildlife. You know, the badgers are, they're loved, they're iconic. You know, people visit badger sets at night to see them moving around, and you know, they're very, very popular. But you know, this is the objections to badger culling are about a bit more than just sentiment, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, there's reasons for opposing it purely on the grounds of, you know, it's wrong to kill so many wild animals. But equally, there are many scientists who are saying that it's vitally important that we deal with the problem of bovine tuberculosis, which, as the name suggests, is a disease of cattle, which can absolutely devastate cattle herds in farms. It can be extremely damaging disease. But a large number of scientists are saying that culling badgers is simply not the way to go about it.
So how have we got to this point where we're saying, actually, the science doesn't support it? And I think it's true to say that has changed. You know, I think back to probably 10 or 11 years ago, when badger culling in the UK was, you know, was first kind of on the table in terms of an actual concrete plan. And that was following a couple of years of culling in Ireland. The Irish cull was a little bit confusing. I remember talking to Lord Krebs, who carried out a review for the government around that time. He's a scientist. And he said to me that the Irish cull initially seemed to actually make the problem worse. But then if the cull continued for a period of time, there were some slight improvements. But, you know, it wasn't exactly a glowing result. And the scientific community were very, very divided over whether culling was the way to go. But it seems to me like that has shifted a little bit over the last couple of years, you know, towards really a conclusion that culling badgers probably doesn't help with the very real and very significant problem of bovine TB. So why are we still doing it? It's, you know, it baffles me.
Well, this is where it comes down to politics. The Conservative, well, coalition government, as it was in 2013, decided that the problem of bovine tuberculosis was very serious and needed to try and, you know, try the option of culling badgers again to see how that would go. Now, this was odd because in many ways the science was already settled. In 1998... the Labour government at the time decided that culling and various measures had been going on in a slightly ad hoc way for a while. And so they drew together a scientific panel who then designed and implemented a thing called the randomised badger cull trial. And this was conducted over quite a long period of time, and it killed an awful lot of badgers, but it was done in an extremely scientifically rigorous way.
Right.
They used very good methodology, they used control groups, they used very extensive testing and gathering of data. And at the end of it, they finally reported in 2007. So, you know, this wasn't just a little run out into a field, do a quick thing and then come back. This
That's
was a
right.
really in-depth study. And in 2007, they reported that on the basis of our careful review of all currently available evidence, we conclude that badger culling is unlikely to contribute positively or cost effectively to the control of cattle TB in Britain.
Right. And that should have been case closed, surely.
That really should have been it. At that point, farming organisations that perhaps had previously thought that culling might be the way to improve matters really should have taken the scientists seriously, and the whole thing should have been put to bed. And clearly it was, as far as the Labour government were concerned at the time. Mm. And still, you know, the latest Labour manifesto said that Labour would discontinue the cull.
Mm.
There's a slight issue in Wales where it seems like the Welsh Labour Administration may be supporting a form of limited culling in certain areas, and there's a bit of dispute about that. But certainly the overall Labour manifesto position is that badger culling is not a good idea.
Can I ask a couple questions, John?
Yep.
One is, in what ways does the badger culling affect ecosystems in the UK, or in what way, you know, might killing such a high number of badgers, kind of negatively affect ecosystems? And also, to what extent does bovine TB have to do with industrial agriculture and the ways in which cattle tend to be raised and produced, you know, for humans to eat them? To what extent is it from that?
Yeah, no, those are very good questions. In terms of ecology, this is the main reason why culling was shown to be counterproductive, because when badgers were culled, the badgers in the area who survived would tend to disperse. It's a phenomenon called perturbation. Basically, they get scared and they run off. Pretty understandable.
Well, I think I might.
And what that often leads to is not only infected badgers spreading over a wider area, but also more badgers becoming infected.
That's right.
And so it basically seems from the science that the best way to increase bovine tuberculosis among badgers, certainly, is to cull them. And if you've got greater incidence of tuberculosis among badgers, then that doesn't directly mean that you're going to have more in cattle, but it creates an extra possibility. So that was a very key issue.
I remember a really excellent study which came out, it was probably about 2009, 2010, which showed that actually the best way, probably, of controlling bovine TB is actually to create barriers to badgers entering the area where the cattle are being raised. And those barriers can be natural. A lot of farms will have natural barriers like waterways and fencing, and actually in the places where, you know, maybe not by design, maybe more by accident, that it's more difficult for badgers to get in, that's probably the best way of reducing interaction between badgers and cattle. But there's also a problem of transmission from cattle to cattle. I mean, that's the other thing that we're just not talking about, is actually what is the kind of biosecurity, the ways that you prevent transmission of these bacteria between cattle. And a lot of that has to do with movement of animals. There's, you know, one of the kind of primary methods in the UK for certainly for rearing food animals is that, you know, there's one farmer who has, you know, calves and raises them to a certain point, and then they move to another farmer to become prepared for food or for milking.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there certainly seems to be a big problem with cattle movement. There's no doubt that cattle to cattle transmission is far and away the main problem. The issue, sometimes those figures are confused by the fact that if the infection originated with badgers, sometimes they get blamed for all the cases of infection that then happen within a farm. But of course, most of those are actually caused by perhaps one or two animals becoming infected and then spreading it to other members of the herd.
Yeah. So why? Who stands to benefit from this? Why is the government doing this despite all of this evidence that not only does badger culling not work, but there are better solutions?
I think we have to look at where the impetus is coming for the badger cull. And a lot of it seems to be coming from the National Farmers Union, which is an organisation that represents not all farmers, primarily the larger, more commercial end of the farming spectrum.
Sure.
And they are clearly absolutely up to their elbows in the badger cull. There have been reports, genuine verified reports of NFU staff actually being in police control rooms when culls are happening and being given information as to whether there are people who are out trying to disrupt the cull. The NFU are getting information and are sharing that with the police.
Wow.
And this really does sort of cross over, you know, a line in terms of the police's role in this, which ought to be to safeguard public safety in terms of the fact there are people going around the countryside with guns, you know, free shooting of badgers, despite the fact that's been shown to be not a humane way of killing badgers. But also, you know, they should be facilitating the rights of people who want to peacefully protest the cull taking place. And yet it seems, certainly to many observers, that the police's role has actually been more one of facilitation of the cull, and of actually, you know, kind of forcing it through against the wishes of many of the public.
Yeah.
In terms of why the badger cull is going ahead under a Tory government against apparently all the science, there are various theories. Badgers have been protected under law since 1992, and undoubtedly during that time their numbers have expanded. They've done well, they've benefited from protection, as you know, you would hope, but that does mean that there are some people who feel that there are too many of them in the countryside. And there's also the issue, whenever you have a protected species, that becomes another factor to take into account in any kind of property development, any kind of land development.
Right.
We have a situation now where the chairman of the government's body for delivering environmental measures, Natural England, is not an ecologist, is not a scientist, is actually a housing developer.
What?
And understandably, people are going to think that with somebody like Andrew Sells running Natural England, there's going to be pressure on Natural England, which has to make many decisions on planning issues and has to decide what kind of environmental measures should be taken when developments are proposed. There's a sense that many of those decisions are perhaps now going to go more in favour of housing developers than they are in favour of the environment. And that frequently involves issues with protected species.
Yeah.
If you want to turn a field into a housing estate and it's got a badger set on it, it's much, much harder than it would be if the badgers didn't have any protection.
Yeah.
So certainly there is a, you know, quite a big body of opinion that feels that this has got a lot to do with development and the fact that badgers are getting in the way of development. There's also a feeling among many people that it could well be related to so-called country sports, things like pheasant shooting, for example. That's you know, quite a lucrative industry in which some 50 million exotic, invasive alien species effectively are introduced into the British ecosystem each year. That's the pheasants that are introduced into the British ecosystem each year weigh more than all the other birds in Britain put together.
What?
And, yep. And badgers, you know, if pushed, if the opportunity arises, you know, don't mind a young pheasant. They don't mind a pheasant egg. And that's an issue. People who are gamekeepers looking after pheasant shoots will get rid of all the predators that they're legally allowed to. They'll get rid of foxes, stoats, weasels. And occasionally they might be, you know, tempted to step beyond the line to protected species, be they badgers, birds of prey, owls, etc.
And have we got evidence that that's happening?
We've certainly got evidence of wildlife crime involving birds of prey, and very extensive so-called legal control, is what they call it euphemistically, of things like foxes. I think it's hugely likely that animals such as badgers will be affected. For a start, there's no doubt at all that badgers, as well as a whole range of other animals, even including domestic cats, get caught up in snares which have been left out supposedly to catch foxes, but are totally indiscriminate in terms of how they catch animals. There was a video which we actually referred to in the Canary that came from a shooting estate. That was actually a grouse shooting estate, but similar attitudes and principles prevail, which showed a badger caught in a snare and a gamekeeper cack-handedly trying to set it free by shooting the snare off while this poor badger leaps around in terror, obviously. You know, if it does seem like the badgers are getting it in the neck for reasons that go well beyond bovine TB.
And actually, I should mention we approached Lord Krebs to see if he would come and talk with us on the podcast today. Unfortunately, he was too busy to join us, but he did say that he liked our article. So I think in terms of our criticism of this on the basis of science, we've got a pretty good endorsement there.
Yeah, that sounds good. In terms of things that people can do about the badger cull, I mean, obviously all the usual things, particularly if you're in the cull areas, which, as I say, predominantly the west and the southwest of England, no doubt, you know, writing to your MP is one thing you can do. You may find that your local MP is a Tory who's up to his knees in it and has got no interest in listening to you, but, you know, you do what you can, and this is ultimately a political decision. And so if there's enough political pressure brought to bear, then we could see some change. In the meantime, there are people who do what they can to try and stop the cull happening.
And is there somewhere where people can find out about those actions?
Absolutely there is. I mean, you can follow links from our articles on the Canary. You can find the group Stop the Cull on Facebook. Some people feel that their methods go too far. Some people feel their methods are entirely necessary, and in fact the only way that we can actually make a difference on this, but anyway, that's up to people. There are a whole raft of groups trying to oppose the badger cull, from big charities like the Wildlife Trusts through to groups like the Badger Trust, and as I say, the more direct action groups as well. Stop the Cull, various hunt saboteurs groups.
Great. Well, we'll put some links in the programme notes to some of those groups so people can find out. Thank you very much, John. I mean, that's just it's one example of where vested interests seem to be just, held way above any kind of evidence base for policy making. And one of the things that we push for at the Canary is the use of good, high quality evidence in policy making, and particular evidence that comes from scientific research, which is, as you say, for this particular area, has been extensive and very high quality, and in more recent times, quite conclusive. So interesting kind of power plays going on there, and the poor badgers are, as you say, getting it in the neck.
Yeah, I think you can't understand British environmental issues without understanding the history of British power, which is almost totally tied into landowning. And I've written about this in the Canary before. If anyone wants to dig into it, they can follow the tags for wildlife crime in our the environment section of our discovery part. And we've always tried to make the link between environmental issues and politics, because you can't really get to grips with one without the other.
We hope you've been enjoying this week's Canary Pod. Before we move on to the second half with Tamara, I just wanted to remind you to subscribe to Canary Pod on your favourite podcast platform. And if you use iTunes, please do rate and review Canary Pod. It's the best way to get the podcast out to more people. Thanks. Welcome back to Canary Pod, the podcast from the team behind the Canary. We're going to move on now to talk about anti-Semitism. Now, we've got Tamara Mechner here, who's a writer at the Canary. Tamara, you've been reporting this week on a study which has actually looked into the extent of anti-Semitism in the UK. Can you just outline what was found in that report?
Yeah, this was a report done by the Institute for Jewish Policy Research in London, working with Ipsos Mori, and it is apparently the largest ever study of anti-Semitism in Britain. So that's important to note that it doesn't include Northern Ireland. But they interviewed more than 5,000 people in 2016 and the beginning of 2017. Mm-hmm. And I think there are a few things. Well, it was an 85-page report, so it's quite extensive.
Gosh.
Yeah. And I think there are a few things that kind of stand out. One is that they make a distinction between people who are more hardcore or what they call softer anti-Semites.
Right.
So people who do have kind of deep-seated bigotry toward Jews in a kind of ideological way. And then people who they say have one or more anti-Semitic ideas, but we wouldn't necessarily call them anti-Semites as such.
Right.
So when you separate that out, they found that there are roughly 5% of British people are, we could call, anti-Semites.
Right.
But in terms of people who have anti-Semitic ideas, they found that it's about 30%. So nearly a third have one or more anti-Semitic ideas, such as the idea that Jews get rich at the expense of others, or these sort of stereotypical tropes, which come from actually a study that asked Jews about some of the more common prejudices that they find to be anti-Semitic.
Yeah. That rings so true with my own experience. So my background is Jewish. I'm Sephardi, hence the Spanish surname.
Right.
And, you know, I remember experiencing anti-Semitism at school. And I remember experiencing anti-Semitism at school from other students. So I remember being on the school bus and being told I should have been gassed with all the rest of them.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. But even more shockingly, I had anti-Semitism from my teachers.
Mm.
I had two teachers who I ended up complaining about who were reprimanded. One of whom was my form tutor. And she used to say to me, she said, "Oh, Nancy, you're so lucky to be Jewish. You're so lucky. You know, Jews are so good with money, brilliant at business. You're so lucky." And, you know, she was not a horrible woman. You know, she was actually a very kind person, a very kind Christian person. Who held those lovely values that come with Christianity. But she was just so woefully ignorant and so taken in by stereotype that she felt it was acceptable to talk to a 14-year-old in that way. So, you know, I'm not surprised to hear that there is some anti-Semitic sentiment. I'd hope that things might have improved a bit in the 20 years since I was at secondary school. But actually, I'm quite surprised that the number is as high as 30%.
Mm. Yeah, I think, one of the things that they point out in the report is the idea that could help explain why, you know, at least some Jews in Britain do feel not necessarily safe, or do feel that anti-Semitism is kind of pervasive, because although we may not feel an imminent threat or a really strong threat of violence or anything like that, you know, one in three non-Jewish people we meet
is likely to hold some sort of prejudicial view about Jews, and in a sort of low level way, whether it's, as you say, from ignorance or, you know, it probably isn't malicious, as you're saying about your teacher. It really just is kind of often, I think, lack of awareness. And I think not 0.5% of the UK population are Jewish. So I think for a lot of people, they may just not actually meet someone Jewish, maybe ever. Yeah. And if, you know, if the education about religion in state schools is problematic in any number of ways, then that will have a big effect on the kind of general level of awareness about different cultures and religions and histories.
And I think it's this low level stuff that's very pervasive as well. I think that's across different minorities as well. When you've always got those low levels, you say, tropes and stereotypes that are being repeated again and again and again, they do make you feel unsafe, and they do contribute to that atmosphere. And actually, it's some of that low-level stuff that needs challenging the most, because in a sense, that is what makes people feel unsafe. It becomes the dominant attitude because it's allowed to sort of pervade everything and appear worse than it is, you know. And actually, it's sometimes much easier to challenge people with much more hardcore views than it is when people are coming from a good place, or they think they're coming from a good place, even though you know it's not a good place. And actually, they become the conversations that are harder to have sometimes as well.
The prejudice becomes very subverted, doesn't it, in that situation. But we're also seeing a rise, you know, internationally in anti-Semitism. And, you know, we've seen the marches of the far right in the States over the last few weeks, who, you know, literally are saying, get rid of the Jews, you know, take back America from the Jews. And, you know, for me personally, I mean, at this point in time, I probably feel more unsafe than I ever have done as a Jewish person. And I'm not, you know, I'm not religious. I'm not kind of talking about this from that point of view, but from a cultural and an ethnic point of view, you know, people who know, you know, people who know that I'm Jewish just by looking at me, you know, and, you know, that means that, you know, what we're dealing with is, you know, it's as much racism as it is anything else. And I think, you know, again, you know, racism in general has become very subversive because it, you know, it's not nice people don't want to be racist. They don't want to be, well, no, nice people don't want to be seen as racist, you know?
Right.
And, you know, that means that, you know, a lot of it isn't kind of out there. And as you say, it's much, much more difficult to counter. Now, you know, I'm talking about in the States, you know, these far right protests. I don't think we can really talk about anti-Semitism on the Canary podcast without talking about what's been happening in the Parliamentary Labour Party over the last couple of years. And, you know, Tamara, this report actually did look at the political kind of persuasions of people within the survey that they did. What's going on with that? Does that support the idea that there are people on the left wing who are inherently anti-Semitic, looking to leverage their bigoted views around policymaking? What was the kind of conclusion there?
Yeah, I think there were a couple of elements of the report that were really positive and helpful in that respect. So the first thing was, as you say, they looked at anti-Semitism across the political spectrum. And one thing they found was that it's kind of strongest on people who identify as very right wing. So that's about 1.5% of people, but that was 1.5 of 2.5% of the hardcore anti-Semites. So basically most of the hardcore anti-Semites in this country are on the far right or the extreme right. And I think that's definitely something to be concerned about in terms of, you know, violence and kind of links between far right movements around the world. Another thing that the report looked at was making a distinction between anti-Israel views and anti-Semitic views, which isn't commonly done.
So important.
Yeah, and they found, as I think we can also attest to, that sometimes there is an overlap, right? But not necessarily. And they found that anti-Israel views are more common among British people than anti-Semitic views. So, right. You know, again, for people who are Jewish who think that any criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic, that will affect how they feel about the level of anti-Semitism in general society. But for those of us who see a distinction, I think that's really kind of helpful to know about. And yeah, I mean, yeah, in terms of the Labour Party, I think it does kind of help vindicate the idea that, well, so one point that the report makes is that on the left, people are no more anti-Semitic than the general population, which is not what we're hearing in mainstream media oftentimes.
Absolutely not. I mean, this theme has been running for a very long time around the Labour Party and around the kind of split between those in the party who support Corbyn and those who don't, and it does seem to have been very centred around, you know, our political relationship with the state of Israel and Israeli government.
Yeah, I mean, if you're someone who thinks that being critical of Israel is anti-Semitic, then you will think that of the left or parts of the left. Yes. But again, in terms of the Labour Party, this was a point that came from someone in the Jewish Voice for Labour, which is a new movement to kind of have a Jewish voice in the Labour Party that is more aligned with kind of Palestinian self-determination and this sort of thing, and representing parts of the left that aren't necessarily having a voice in labor from the Jewish community. They said that, you know, for the Jews who are kind of calling out Jeremy Corbyn and people around him for being anti-Semitic, they genuinely do believe that. And it's not weaponizing. So I think that's important to know. I think that can be the case for people who aren't Jewish and see this as a way to try and, you know, remove power from him and so on. But yeah, I think that's very real for people in the Jewish community, certainly what I've encountered. So I don't think that that's disingenuous. And that was Joseph Finley who kind of made that comment. Yeah.
That's really interesting. And I think, There's an awful lot about media reporting of issues that affect minorities in the UK that just completely miss the point that what they're talking about is the lived experience of people.
Sure.
And now, you know, this report is actually really kind of, you know, asking the question, what is the experience of Jewish people in the UK? Which is, I think that's the first time I've seen anyone even attempt that. And certainly in my experience, you know, I'm Jewish culturally and ethnically. And I'm not a Zionist. I don't believe that, you know, the state of Israel has a God-given right to exist. And that, you know, that view has, you know, invited all kinds of responses to me. I mean, I've had everything from, you know, you're a self-hating Jew. I'm like, well, right. I'm not a self-hating Jew. I'm really proud of my heritage. You know, I love it. I know I've gained a lot from having that cultural upbringing. So I'm not a self-hating Jew. And I've had other people tell me that I'm so brave to hold the opinions that I do as a Jew about, you know, what, you know, in actual fact, you know, what is going on in Israel and Palestine is an ethnic apartheid. And it's no different from any other ethnic apartheid that we've seen throughout history. You know, in Israel, your identity card includes your ethnicity. And it includes Jewish as an ethnicity, so you're Jewish. And within that there is also huge racism. We've seen racism against Ethiopian Jews who've come into Israel, and some of the women who've come in were basically forced to be sterilized. It's, you know, it's just, and then actually, you know, if I went to Israel, you know, I wouldn't have the chance to own property or get an education in the same way as the American and European Jews who are from the Ashkenazi ethnic group, because I'm Sephardi. Right. Because I'm Sephardi, you know, I don't match that. I don't match that vision of what this state of Israel is supposed to look like. And there are many, many Jews living in Israel who are Sephardi by background, or they're Mizrahi. And the Mizrahi Jews are actually the, you know, if you like, the original Jews. They're the Jews who have been in the Middle East for forever. And that really shocks me that, you know, the state of Israel was formed in response to the atrocities in Europe during the Second World War and the years running up to it. And now the Israeli government is perpetrating an ethnically based apartheid where it has actually enclosed people who are not Jewish, who are not white, in open prisons. You know, if you go to Gaza, it's surrounded by an enormous wall, and there are sentries all along the wall with AK-47s. You know, and people talk about a two-state solution. Well, you know, I don't think that's right either, because, you know, this is not an area of the world that was previously unoccupied. And it's really interesting when I talk to my mum about this. So my mum's 70. She was born, you know, just after the end of the Second World War. And her family were very progressive, certainly politically left-wing. Yet they still held the belief that there was just this sand pit in the Middle East that was waiting for somebody to come and move in and develop it, which is just absolutely just ridiculous. So, you know, my point is there are many, many reasons that are completely secular. They're nothing to do with religion or whether somebody is Jewish. They are absolutely to do with a state that is perpetrating human rights crimes. So conflating anti-Semitism and criticism of the state of Israel, you know, to me just seems completely ridiculous. Yet it seems to be, you know, continuing and even strengthening in this weird kind of political fight that's going on. And, you know, I would really like to see that stop, because actually it takes away something from me talking about that. Because, you know, as you've said, 30% of people in the UK hold some kind of anti-Semitic sentiment. And, right. And actually, that's horrible. It's really horrible for me to be walking around knowing that. And actually, you know, nothing about what's happening in politics around anti-Semitism is talking about the lived experience of Jewish people. You know, none of it is actually acknowledging the real impact of anti-Semitism. Now, there's nothing about this that says, well, you know, that Jew over there is having a horrible time, we should do something about it. That's not what it's about.
Right.
No, absolutely. And we've talked a lot about vested interests and powerful interests in this podcast with the arms industry and with the budget cull. And that's also true in terms of Israel. And the Israeli lobby is so powerful and has so much political backing that's one of the reasons why that's so dominant in that narrative, and why we end up talking about that rather than that lived experience here. And I think, for example, so my dad's Jewish and he's never had any problems with the messages that Corbyn and Corbyn's Labour Party have been putting out. And those are the messages that are coming from a lot of the mainstream media and the tabloid press. And it's, again, it's where those vested interests are and how we're looking at them and how we're exploring those relationships and how they get out there without being questioned. And at the same time, this lived experience is totally ignored.
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing that I've heard from people is that sometimes when those of us who are Jewish call out anti-Semitism, that it's not necessarily taken seriously or acknowledged as a type of racism and a type of prejudice and a type of oppression. And part of that is the idea that maybe Jews have relatively a fair amount of privilege, which is also a problematic idea, obviously. Sure. But yeah, I think, you know, on the left and in general in society, we need to take that seriously as a type of racism and a type of oppression as well. Yeah.
Yeah. So what can we do to counter both, you know, the anti-Semitic sentiment that exists in the UK and this ridiculous conflation of anti the state of Israel and anti-Semitism?
Yeah, I think one thing in terms of, let's say, domestic anti-Semitism is, you know, for people who aren't Jewish but, you know, consider themselves allies, is, you know, to call it out when you hear something anti-Semitic, or if you know someone Jewish who voices an experience of anti-Semitism, to kind of hear that and be open to it, and for all of us to kind of take part in calling that out and examining, like, the prejudices that we have. In terms of the Labour Party, yeah, I don't know. I'm interested in what the two of you think. I think, again, you know, trying to call it out. But I think, yeah, hopefully an organization like Jewish Voice for Labour will be a positive force that we will be able to make some inroads.
I think so. And I think where these attitudes exist in the Labour Party, they need to be called out and they need to be highlighted and not washed over. But at the same time, we also need to recognise that that is not the majority, and that it's a load of hype and spin that's being used against the Labour Party as well.
Well, and Labour allies as well. I mean, it's not just the Labour Party. I mean, you know, we at the Canary and Kerry-Anne particularly, who's reported from Israel and Palestine in the past, you know, we're often accused of being anti-Semitic, which, you know, I hope this discussion today, you know, does something to kind of lay that to rest. I mean, the Canary is not an anti-Semitic organisation. There are several of us involved who are Jewish by background, you know, we're really keen to kind of emphasise the problem of conflating those two ideas.
Yeah, and I think in terms of the Labour Party again, or kind of people around it, that maybe we need to look differently at the ways in which anti-Semitism is being used by people who aren't Jewish as opposed to people who are.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because, you know, it is quite different if someone genuinely believes, you know, I feel that this is anti-Semitic, I experience this as anti-Semitism, then we, you know, that's a very different process for addressing that than someone who is weaponizing it knowingly.
Yeah. As somebody with no Jewish heritage, certainly not that I'm aware of, I sort of tend to feel on this issue that it's my place to listen more than to speak. But equally, you know, I'm happy to say that I wouldn't want to be associated with anti-Semitism in any form. And equally, I believe very strongly in having sensible discussions about the situation in Israel-Palestine. And I think we can do that often on a political level, to bring ethnicity into it. Often does little more than muddy the waters, although clearly you have to have an understanding of it in order to get through to the complexities of the subject.
Yeah.
I think sometimes ethnicity is brought in perhaps too early as a way of dividing people, and as a way of perhaps removing the option for really good discussion.
Yeah.
So I think it's like so many things. You have to take people as you find them. You have to deal with issues honestly and straightforwardly. And at the same time, you know, you have to give no place to bigotry, no place to hate speech. So yeah, it's very interesting to read this report that's just come out, to see the conclusions that it draws. And I think, you know, while it shows that actually real kind of, you know, full-on anti-Semitism is thankfully a relatively rare occurrence, it shows that we've got absolutely no room for complacency.
Yeah.
And that we all need to examine our attitudes constantly.
Yeah. We do not want to slip in the direction that parts of the USA have recently.
Just on the idea of sort of where does this kind of fear of anti-Semitism or criticism of Israel come from, mm-hmm. within the Jewish community? I think I would say, you know, maybe it's helpful for people who aren't Jewish or kind of haven't been exposed to the Jewish community just to know that a lot of it, I think, is communal trauma that's a legacy of the Holocaust.
Absolutely.
And that definitely informs, I think, kind of the state of Israel in terms of its policies and just society as well, from what I know. Mm. But definitely in the UK and like in Canada, where I grew up, and around the world, I think even if people don't have relatives who died in the Holocaust or were directly affected by it, it's kind of a community-wide trauma that still exists. Yeah. And that's something that has to be worked on kind of within the community. But I think that's a big part of where it's coming from, this fear.
I certainly feel that personally. And, you know, I think the way I've seen that play out in my own family is, you know, a reluctance to kind of put one's head above the parapet, a reluctance to be conspicuous, a reluctance to disclose your Jewishness. And that's, you know, that's something that I've always struggled with, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very, very real. So, you know, this is clearly, it's a complex kind of series of interconnecting issues, all of which I think we need an awareness of, and we need to be, you know, clear about how we can oppose, you know, bigotry and racism and prejudice. What are the sorts of things that people can do?
I think maybe getting involved in an anti-racism organization of some kind, or educating ourselves about these issues. I mean, of course, people can read more articles from the Canary about anti-Semitism and Israel-Palestine and racism generally. Mm-hmm. I know there's Stand Up to Racism. There is also a Jewish organization that I'm part of that's very cool called JEWDAS, JEWDAS, mm-hmm. Deliberate pun. And it is a basic kind of a collective of people who are non-Zionist or anti-Zionist, anti-fascist, anti-racist, standing in solidarity with other minorities, but also quite ironic and funny about it.
Sounds great.
And and JEWDAS are on Facebook and Twitter, and I think that's kind of a good entry point. There's also the Boycott, Divest, Sanctions movement against Israel. That's a grassroots movement that emerged from Palestine as a nonviolent form of protest. Nice.
And that was, you know, that was the BDS movement against South Africa was incredibly successful in the 1980s. So, you know, we know that that's an effective form of protest when it comes to an apartheid state.
No, absolutely. And again, you know, the BDS movement has been accused of anti-Semitism as well. But again, it is just looking at Zionism and supporting the rights of Palestinian people. And as we've sort of looked at in this podcast, they're very, very separate issues. Yeah. And really important that we acknowledge that. There's also the anti-fascist network, which is more sort of grassroots action against racists and fascists when they turn up on the streets. So that's very much sort of going and protesting against them directly.
Yeah.
So if people want to get involved in that side of things, that's also very important to have a sort of street presence.
So we'll include some links to those organisations in the podcast notes. Tamara, thank you very much for bringing us the details of that report. I think we've had a good discussion and touched on some really important points. You know, the lived experience of Jewish people experiencing anti-Semitism, you know, the desire that people have to conflate anti-Zionist with anti-Semitic, and also, you know, what's happening in the Labour Party where the term anti-Semitism is, you know, effectively being used as a political weapon to kind of divide and conquer. All really important stuff. So thank you for that. I think that's it really for this week. We should round up here. Thank you very much indeed, John Ranson, Emily Apple and Tamara Michner, for joining me today for this episode of Canary Pod. We'll see you next week. And in the meantime, don't get angry, get involved.